Welcome to the Hugo-nominated SF Squeecast, in which a group of science fiction and fantasy professionals squee about all things SFNL in a never-ending panel discussion of vague positivity. I'm Lynn Thomas, your moderator, and today I am joined by SF Squeecast regulars Elizabeth Baer.
Hello.
Paul Cornell.
Good evening.
And our very special guest this evening is award-winning SF author Lois McMaster-Bujold.
Hi there.
We are so pleased that you're here, Lois.
Yay.
As you may have noticed from the sound of people clapping, which doesn't always happen when we record, this is the live episode of the Squeecast. We are recording once again live at Convergence, and we are really,
Yay.
Really pleased. Yay, Convergence! They made it possible for us to record again this year, and we are really thrilled, and we want to thank them, especially Tim Wick, who took one for the team and made this happen at the very last minute. So we want to say thank you to all of them. Thank you, Convergence. We love you. Best con ever. Come to it. Okay. We have several things to talk about today. Everybody brings something to the podcast to talk about, and because we only have an hour and we usually record for about an hour and 20 minutes, I'm just going to herd cats today and not necessarily talk about anything in particular. We're going to start with Baer, if that's all right. And Baer this week has brought two books, Ian Tregellis's Bitter Seeds and the sequel The Coldest War. So, Baer?
Okay. Ob disclaimer, Ian is a friend of mine and the guy who does a lot of my astrophysics math. So if you're going to write me complaining about my math, just cut to the chase and write directly to Ian. I'm sorry, Ian. These books are not light, happy bath time reading, unless you like to bathe in the blood of the innocent, murdered by the thousands. What Ian has done is he has taken the Second World War and created an alternate historical fantasy universe in which the Nazis, because they're Nazis, they're evil and crazy, you don't have to choose just one, have decided that the ideal thing to do would be to create superheroes. And how they do this is by taking a whole bunch of orphaned children and wiring their brains up, attaching them to battery to storage batteries, and then torturing them horribly until they develop superpowers in order to escape. This may have some...
What could possibly go wrong?
Go wrong! Meanwhile, back in England...
Sounds just like school to me.
Except for the superpowers part. Yeah, I never managed to manifest any. Meanwhile, back in England, we have a whole bunch of sorcerers who are trying to figure out how they're going to defend the Allies from this superpowered blitz, basically. You know, you've got a guy who can walk through walls. You have a woman who can see the future. You have a guy who's a pyromancer. And because of the circumstances under which they develop their powers, none of them are particularly stable, but many of them manage to be sympathetic characters. And the opposite. So he does a very nice job of building a world in which there are no... I can't say there are no villains, because Nazis... They are, you know, the go-to villain of our times. You don't have to apologize for Nazis. But he does a very good job of showing how the exigencies of war make everybody make horribly immoral choices. And showing the things, because the way that the sorcery that the English are using works is that there's it's a fee for service kind of sorcery. It's blood sorcery. You have to sacrifice to get things from these demonic intelligences that they're bargaining with. And I don't want to talk too much about the plot, because it winds up being very intricate and reversey, and I don't want to spoil the fun of that. I will say that the first book takes place during World War II. The second book takes place during the Cold War. You know, 15, 20 years later. And the third book, which comes out next year, I think, it would actually be kind of a spoiler to talk about when that takes place. The third book is called, I believe, Necessary Evils. The prose style is fabulous. The characterizations are wonderful. One of the people who does some of the most horrible things in the books is this, you know, sort of upper middle class British guy who really just wants to plant his tomatoes and take care of his wife. People are extraordinarily sympathetic, except for when they are doing horrible things, which is the thing I find is extraordinarily hard for a writer to pull off. And the world building is just so intensely charismatic. It holds up. It has he does this thing where you talk about writers who ask the third question. You know, okay, so this is where it's very easy to go, this is the way I want my world to be because it's cool. Well, then you have to go, well, why is it like that? And then you have to go, well, why is that like that? And if you do that, you have that depth of feeling that there's reasons and why force for the contradictions in the world and how it works. It's good stuff, and I really think everybody should read it. There was a big gap between the first and second books because he had some there was some sort of a shakeup with his. He wound up changing editors at Tor, and he seems to be back on a book a year schedule now. And I really recommend these things. They're great. One of the great little lost gems of alternate history currently being written.
Neat. So it sounds like the key to world building then is just to turn into a 5-year-old and keep saying, why?
Why?
But why?
Why? But why? But why? I think so.
Well, there you go. That's really
Squeakcast writer tips.
Yep. Turn into a 5-year-old and keep asking why.
Are the sorcerers involved, you know, real life British sorcerers of World War II? The Unfortunate Aleister Crowley?
No. No, he is using largely invented characters. There are some historical characters, but they are mostly relegated to secondary and tertiary roles, which I actually kind of like. Because one of the things that annoys me about alternate history is when it becomes, and now we will, you know, now we're going to waltz Winston Churchill across the page because we can. Here, see the, don't mind the puppet rots.
Okay, has anybody else had a chance to read these books? No? All right. No. We're going to move on to our next topic, which is also apparently very, very serious. You guys picked really serious books today.
Well, we thought we'd really, really entertain the audience by being deeply serious and thoughtful.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just looked at the stack of stuff on my nightstand. So I like those.
So Paul today has brought Pattern Recognition by William Gibson. Paul?
Well, Pattern Recognition by William Gibson is, perhaps it's safe to say, not an SF novel. He hasn't written recognisably SF for quite a while, after being the doyen of the cyberpunk movement. But it's still got a dirty great central concept, which I think marks it as fantasy, or literary fantasy. Our heroine, Chase, is allergic to trademarks. She has a huge reaction to the presence of the most everyday trademark. She has to wear very basic clothing in a very particular style, out of which she has removed every trademark and note of manufacturer. She is afraid of the Michelin Man.
Aren't we all?
It's kind of frightening.
There is a scene in this book where the Michelin Man, a tiny little doll of which, is knotted to a doorknob into her flat in an attempt to scare her and possibly prevent her entering. And it takes her a long time to negotiate getting past the Michelin Man on the doorknob. No, it's really good. She uses this skill for advertising agencies who show her their new campaign, and she will immediately be able to tell whether or not that's a good way to sell the product, whether or not that's going to be a useful campaign for them, because she's very, very sensitive to how symbols work in the world. And through her, Gibson explores, basically this is a map of modern manners, of what the world is like now, or it's a few years old now, what the world was like in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Because, and it takes a while for you to realise this is a 9/11 novel. Her condition didn't start in the wake of 9/11, but it was very much exacerbated by it. And the loss of her father in the 9/11 attacks. And when we say loss, they don't know if he's dead. He just went missing in New York that day. And her mother especially is hearing his voice in electronic voice phenomena on tape. And again is extracting a signal out of what is just noise, which really annoys our heroine. The plot of the book, it's an attempt at a modern thriller, but it's a very careful, slow-paced literary thriller. You know, I wouldn't come here expecting the same thrills as from, you know, Walter John Williams or something like that. It's more of a journey through London and Tokyo. The London portrayed, it's a bit like the Danny Boyle movie, A Life Less Ordinary, which really annoyed American audiences because Danny Boyle, Scottish filmmaker, let loose in the States, just did endless pans of beautiful stateside scenery, which for you guys is just, yes, yes, that's where it is, get on with it. And there's a little bit of that in William Gibson's London, in the fascination with detail. It's like, yes, yes, I know, but some of it is, oh, yes, that's a detail I've never seen before, which is surely a mark of great writing, even though it's all around me. The footage, mysterious bits of what may be an artwork being put together over many years, which crop up on the internet and in strange places, and she is part of a group of internet fans of the footage who are looking into what this might be. And gradually it becomes apparent that intelligence agencies and companies are also interested in this footage, and that wraps up in her into an increasingly dangerous plot. Gibson's Tokyo is strangely restrained. It's as if he's aware that he really cyberpunked up Tokyo in the past, and that actually it's quite a dull and very rural city, and so he gives us a bit of that. And it's a very refreshing novel. It makes you feel better about the world. It lets you see the world through literally different eyes. And it makes you very much aware of the power of trademarks all around us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how much that symbolism has kind of infected us. It's almost like magic. It's like it's a urban fantasy novel about trademarks. And I heartily recommend it, as is always the case for the SF Squeakcast.
Okay. Did you have something you wanted to add about that novel?
No, I have not read it, but it makes me want to.
I have read it. I have not read it since it came out, however. So this would be... it came out in 2003?
Something that's like right. That?
Yeah, so this is a 9-year-old recollection of the book. I really liked it. I found it kind of compulsively readable. And it was during a time in my life. Writers go through these phases where we can't read fiction. It just becomes anathema to us because our critical faculty gets so engaged that every single sentence you have to, you're sitting there wanting to rewrite the entire book, which is not how you want to read a story. And I clearly remember that this particular book was like the book that I managed to start reading fiction again with when I was going through one of those phases. It has so many just wonderful little brilliant gems of observation and these conceits and these little bits of magical thinking that may or may not be true. My personal favorite is the one, the explanation for jet lag.
Oh, the soul. The
yes,
soul
jet lag is what jet lag happens because your soul can't keep up with you. So the further you go and the faster you go, the longer it takes your soul to catch up with you. So and some souls are faster than others, so those people, you know, don't suffer. It's all that delightful. I mean, everything in this book is that delightful. There's a Moscow sequence too, isn't there? Which is and I have never been to Moscow, but reading it was very. I thought the city was very strongly evoked. You would have to ask somebody who has both been there and read the book if it was accurate, but I got a real feel for it, which I think is the...
There's something noir about the narration, but not cliched noir, just a sighing acceptance of fate that really buoys you along.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very compulsively readable in the best Gibson tradition without having his... The scattershot... he's learned to write transitions.
Speaking as a writer reading.
I wholeheartedly second the recommendation. It's a good book.
Okay. Thank you. All right, so the next thing on our list is the book that Lois has brought to us today, which, in keeping with the rest of what the Squeakcast has brought, is a deeply serious book called Bat Bomb by Jack Coffer. So, Lois, why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
Bat Bomb, I was pressed into my hand soon after it was published in 1992 and became my favorite World War II true memoir. I was told I could bring anything. I thought of various things to bring to the Squeakcast. You know, Sherlock, everybody's talking about that. He doesn't need more. Georgia Dyer, they're doing a retrospective on her books over on Tor.com this month, you know, so people are aware of her. But this one is not so well known, so I thought I would use this opportunity to get the book out. Everybody should read this book because it is loony. It's World War II's other secret weapon. Life magazine calls it one of the most extraordinary military operations ever conceived. And I don't know, I think probably the quickest way to describe it is just read the back cover copy, which is reasonably accurate. It was a crazy way to win World War II in the Pacific. All the United States had to do was to attach small incendiary bombs to millions of bats and release them over Japan's major cities. As the bats went to roost, a million fires would flare up in remote crannies of the wood and paper buildings common throughout Japan. When their cities were reduced to ashes, the Japanese would surely capitulate. The plan made sense to a handful of eccentric promoters and researchers who convinced top military brass and even President Roosevelt to back the scheme. It might have worked, except that another secret weapon, something to do with atoms, was chosen to end the war. Told here by the youngest member of the team, this is the story of the Bat Bomb Project, or Project X-Ray, as it was officially known. Jack Coffer recounts the unorthodox experiments carried out in the secrecy of Bandera, Texas, Carlsbad, New Mexico, and El Centro, California in 1942 to 1943 by Doc Adams' private army. This oddball cast of characters included an eccentric inventor, a distinguished Harvard scientist, a biologist with a chip on his shoulder, a movie star, a Texas guano collector, a crusty Marine Corps colonel, a Maine lobster fisherman, an ex-mobster, and a tiger. Yes. Could not make this up, you know? Not to be defeated by minor logistical hurdles, the bat bomb researchers risked life and limb to explore uncharted bat caves and recruit thousands of bats to serve their country. Through months of personality conflicts, military snafus, and technical failures, the team pressed on, certain that bats could end the war with Japan. And they might have. In their first airborne test, the bat bombers burned an entire brand-new military airfield to the ground. So this is Bat Bomb. It is from the University of Texas Press. I could go on and read other excerpts now, on how much you want.
Now, with the back cover, I happen to know a little bit about Project X-Ray because it is one of my favorite tidbits of World War II trivia. What the cover copy fails to tell you is that these were kamikaze bats. there was no consideration made for releasing the bat from the incendiary device before the incendiary device detonated. So I really don't blame.
Down.
Yes, I really don't blame the bats for burning down anything they could get to. I think it was.
It was a different world then, and this really gives you a sense of it. Coffer was 19 when he was swept up in this. When Pearl Harbor happened, he was out. He was working as an assistant to a University of California scientist, a mammalogist. And that's how he kind of got swept up into it. These things happened in those days. It was who you knew. My father would have been on the Manhattan Project if he'd had a different instructor that quarter at Caltech. Yeah. So it's reading this has, you know, brought back a lot of his anecdotes and that feeling about my parents talking about the times. You know, it was a very different world then, but not so far from me as it is from, you know, all the younger people in the room. So it was this sounds like just what they would have done back then.
It would have made the Cold War a lot different if instead of the atomic bomb, every nation had got the bat bomb. Brazil would be a major world power.
We cannot allow a bat cave gap.
But it worked. It would have worked, you know, but it got snaffled up in, you know, personality conflicts and turf
and
wars, actually.
And the intransigence of the bats.
Yes. The bats were not entirely cooperative. I don't know, you feel sorry for the bats.
What was the tiger for?
It belonged to one of the guys in the group. He was told to get rid of it, and he tried, but it came back.
So that's where the song came from.
Tried to give it to him. He gave it to what he thought was a Marine Corps colonel, which actually turned out to be a deserter who was driving a stolen car, and they caught up with him. The tiger ended up in jail for a day, and they called him, and he had to, like, come get it back. The tiger had never been behind bars before. It was a refugee from a petting zoo who had outgrown its original job. And these guys were all running around Texas, you know, searching in bat caves, you know, trying to catch bats to pack into these bombs. You know, thousands of bats in a unit, little egg carton things. The bomb would open up and the bats would fall out and they'd fly, you know, fly to their refuge in whatever you wanted to burn down. If it was the control tower of the Army base, well, that's what went.
Yeah, the problem there is controlling the bats when they're not over enemy territory.
Yeah, the military guys, you know, he's got a lot of the memos quoted in this book, you know, verbatim, that he pulled out of, you know, 50 years they became declassified. And reading between the lines, you can just kind of get the personalities. It's a very fine, very fine.
Read the burning down of our air base.
Bat Bomb by Jack Coffer, University of Texas Press. It is now, according to Amazon, it's now available as an ebook as well.
Ooh.
So it should be quite easy to get.
Yeah. All right. We're out of topics.
Oh,
you had something.
Yeah, I guess I do have to squee after all. I was thinking I would get away with not
and
having
we
to
do
it.
And we do have some embarrassing questions we can ask Lois.
Yes, we do, and we will do that.
They're not really embarrassing.
They're not really embarrassing, but, you know, in the fine tradition of the attempt to be, like, a cross between inside the actor's studio and some sort of other torturous thing.
I suppose we could also kill some time by going to the audience to ask if they have anything to contribute about bat bombs.
If you've been affected by any issues... or how many people to a deserter.
So, I mean, would the utility belts that go with bat bombs be available in, like, the, you know, the Army surplus?
Yes, but you have to go into these special Bruce Wayne, like little tiny explosive bat belts.
Well, there's something we need to, you know, consider is how the narrative of Batman as a character would change in the advent of the bat bomb.
That would be so tasteless, wouldn't it?
with this utility belt full of things, yes. Those poor bats. Those bats were heroes.
Yeah. we'll find the true origin of the legs, nylon, egg, plastic containers.
Let the record state for those listening at home that was very nearly a snarf.
Okay. He talks about the, you know, that you wouldn't think about this today, but he tries to bring you into the mindset of, you know, California in 1942, just after Pearl Harbor, you know, people were scared to death. My parents talked about this. It really seemed that they needed to do something. This was a guy with an idea.
And I think it's interesting that it actually worked. I mean, that's the crazy sort of
it. It was just targeting that was the issue.
Yeah.
No, if you could just mind control the bats. maybe if you could convince the bats that they're not expendable, you know, feed them a little line.
In week one of the project, no air bases were burned down. In week three of the project, no air bases. In week two of the project, one air base was burned down.
Yeah, well, just picture the sign, weeks since an air base burned down. Days since air base burned down, zero. Yes.
I feel bad for the sort of the foot soldier who ends up being the person stuck cleaning up all the back guano as they're trying to get everything sorted.
How about the guy who has to? How about the guy who has to catch all the flies because these bats have to eat something?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Mealworms, it turns out.
Oh, mealworms.
Okay, so.
How about the guy who has to actually attach the thing?
Yeah, and then the person who has to put the little belts on the back.
If you're in a bomber with a bat bomb, you really don't want to be attacked by fighters and have a hole in the bat bomb developed.
No, because then the bats may fly out and roost elsewhere.
It could be very messy. There's a hand up.
I've heard of an isolated island in the Pacific that is absolutely full of bats and the guano. It goes with them. It was actually fought over between nations for the guano. He's heard of it too. So perhaps this might not have worked because the bats will all gravitate towards that on their way.
Yeah. Prior to modern chemistry, bat guano was a military resource because you could make munitions out of it.
Yeah, saltpeter.
Saltpeter and other things.
Oh, yes, I know where I heard it now. It's one of the islands that could be a part of the state of Hawaii, but isn't for that reason.
So Hawaii's like, I don't know, there's an awful lot of bats over there. Maybe they should keep it.
Well, actually,
it also is a fertilizer, by the way.
Well, turned into a fertilizer test site.
In the wake of Pearl Harbor, if we'd gone with the bat bomb, that would have become just beautiful, heroic irony that we would be using the resource from one of the islands of Hawaii to strike back.
Actually, it's in Texas, but yeah.
I think there's your next alternate history novel.
I'm not sure it's a tremendously interesting alternate. Well, actually, it is.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it is. This is the one in which it turns out that splitting the atom really would detonate the atmosphere.
Atmosphere's detonated? One.
Okay. I think we have to move on to the next topic. Okay. I was going to talk about the seventh Doctor era of Doctor Who, because Yay. Every time I talk about Doctor Who in front of Paul, he squirms a little, and that is what makes it fun. So, Paul, this is for you.
Shake it off, big guy.
That's
Shake
right.
it off.
It's all good. The seventh Doctor era is what made me a fan of Doctor Who, and I'm thinking about it a lot because, Sophie Aldred is at this convention. And she played Ace during that era, and her character is pretty much the character that made me love Doctor Who, like, as a series. Like, Sophie's performance as Ace is the thing that unlocked fanishness in me as a person. So it's kind of this really weird thing where, like, Sophie Aldred literally taught me to squee, and her ears are probably burning right now. Because when she decided to... Well, when it was written that her character would beat up a Dalek with a baseball bat, I went, this is the best thing ever! and fanishness was born within me in a way that I had never experienced before. But one of the things I really love about the Seventh Doctor's era that is sometimes in received fan wisdom not given enough credit is the amount of experimentation that happened. When Andrew Cartmell came on as the script editor, he came in and ended up doing a lot of he tried to Alan Moore up Doctor Who, which is always an interesting option. But he used a lot of new writers, and he used a lot of concepts and themes that had not been explored on Doctor Who before. There was an effort to make the Doctor more mysterious again, which hadn't really happened in quite some time. And he brought in several new companions, including Ace. But I also want to just give a little bit of love to Bonnie Langford's Mel, because she's more awesome than she gets credit for, despite the screaming. And to be fair, Bonnie Langford is the best screamer in the history of the series, in my opinion. Like, there is no one who can give you just a contact headache faster than Bonnie Langford when she screams at a monster. And one of my favorite moments in Dragonfire is the scene where Bonnie and Ace are where Mel and Ace are next to each other, and the dragon from Dragonfire sort of, you know, ambles down the hallway as the monsters do in Doctor Who. And Bonnie lets out this blood-curdling scream, and you see this look on Sophie's face, which is actual pain on her part, as she's listening to Bonnie scream her lungs out right in her ear. And it was one of those perfect character moments, because Ace is just like... Ace is groping for explosives while Mel is screaming her head off. And that pretty much encapsulates the shift in the series from, we're thinking of this as sort of children's television, and we're not really thinking about it as trying to tell slightly slightly more serious stories or slightly more complicated stories to moving towards an attempt to do something slightly more serious. Also, I think that for me, the scariest Doctor Who episode, to me personally, is Greatest Show in the Galaxy because I hate clowns. They scare me so badly. And just, you know, just having my favorite character turn to the camera and be like, I hate clowns. It's like, yeah, yeah, me too. I'm down with that. All right. This is awesome. Thank you. So this is me squeeing in public because I've never done that before about Doctor Who and specifically about the Seventh Doctor's era. And I love Sylvester McCoy's performance. Can I just say that?
My favorite.
Yeah. You know, this is something that he especially, okay, I may be the only person on the planet who actually likes Time and the Ronnie. I think that Kate O'Mara is splendid, and the bigger the hair and the shoulder pads, the better. Because if you aren't going to go for it in 1987, then you really shouldn't do it. I mean, she just came off of Dynasty. Are you okay? Oh, did I break you?
I lived through 1987.
But seriously, if you're going to do it, you have to go for it. Right? You have to go for the big hair and the big makeup and the shoulder pads. And Kate O'Mara, bless her, she went for it. And just... I cannot explain my love for the Ronnie enough because Kate O'Mara is one of my favorite Kate O'Mara as the Ronnie is one of my favorite Doctor Who villains. She's completely over the top in a story that makes absolutely no sense where these tetraps, so we're back to the bats because they're giant bats with three eyes who listen to the Ronnie and she treats them poorly and eventually they turn on her.
You know, this is why the flying monkeys need to unionize.
Yes! Well, that's basically what happened is that the tetraps were like, screw this, we're going to go work for the other... This is our planet, get out of here! You know, they just decided to take it on themselves.
Their voices are a little different to that.
Yes, yeah. They weren't quite as squeaky, oddly enough. So,
and they don't say, get out of here!
No.
Get out of here!
No, they just trap the Ronnie in one of her own traps. And yet again, the Doctor doesn't really have to do much. He just lets the various people on the planets turn against one another and you know, sends the Ronnie off into space for a while, randomly to see what happens, and you know, then she comes back later. So, also, I have this firmly held opinion that if you don't love Battlefield, I don't want to know you. Particularly the Brigadier. I need to translate for the people at home. Everyone is laughing because Scott Lynch is like throwing up. Yeah,
Scott Lynch is throwing horns in the audience.
Yes, yes, Scott.
Some of us, however, who experience things on this side of the pond may have had a chance to read the truly excellent novelization. We also got a chance to see what the TV budget of that movie looked like.
You people, honestly.
It's still adorable.
You know, the thing is, I actually thought that I don't think the Destroyer looks that bad.
He looks
really
wonderful.
He's really, for the period, given the budget and the time.
He just doesn't move his neck much.
No. As long as you aren't expecting him to be able to have peripheral vision, which we don't expect peripheral vision of our Doctor Who monsters.
Well,
we
it's not like
plain
Batman doesn't have peripheral vision.
No. There are lots of superheroes that don't have peripheral vision. Why should Doctor Who monsters have it?
There is. The classic Doctor Who monster body language is to lock one's shoulders straight, look straight ahead and then move your entire body to the left, looking that way, to the right, looking that way, and then raising one arm, dash something off a table.
That's one Coke Zero bottle that will never bother anyone again.
Puny humans.
Also, I love Survival, which is the last Sylvester McCoy episode when the show was actively the BBC was actively attempting to kill the show at this point. They put it up against Coronation Street, which is, you know, the most popular show in the history of ever at that point. And you know, they're basically, you know, they're doing their best to kill the ratings so that the show dies a horrible fiery death because the folks in charge of the BBC, it's Michael Grade, is that the person we're blaming these days?
Well, I bet it was Powell.
John. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not a historian. I'm just a fan.
I've had parts of my brain erased about it.
You've blocked all this out at this point, haven't you, Paul? But the BBC was actively trying to kill the show. And as a result, what you end up with in Battlefield is a voiceover ending where the Doctor and Ace sort of wander off into the sunset. It's his final set of lines, and they're sort of... It's wonderful, though, because you don't get a proper leaving story, but you do get them literally wandering off into the sunset. And there's really nothing that can't be done with fun fur. This is the other lesson from survival. Because the basic story is cat people, and the master becoming a cat person. Because why not? If you're Anthony Ainley, why not? You know, cat powers are powerful. You know, you get really good sight and teeth and fun fur. So you can't go wrong with fun fur, especially when filming in a quarry when it's 115 degrees in the shade.
I got a tweet this afternoon saying that Anthony Ainley used to be the person who talked cricket at SF conventions, mm-hmm. or Doctor Who conventions. And that he once got a high-speed ball knocked into his groin during one such demonstration. and it adds something if you have a visual memory of Anthony Ainley in Doctor Who with his great dignity. There we are, you see. The mental picture is taking effect.
I wish the people at home could see the audience's faces.
Yeah, they're basically all just squirming on Anthony Ainley's behalf as they think about a cricket ball hitting him squarely in the package.
Squirming and then giggling and then squirming some more.
Oh, goodness.
That was rather good, I thought. His tissue was compressed.
His tissue was compressed. Okay. Do we want to do an invisible cup of tea since we have about 10 extra minutes before we ask Lois some embarrassing questions?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay.
Hang on.
We got to do the Foley. This is the invisible cup of iced tea, because you'll hear ice.
Our Foleys are very golden age of radio here.
That's right.
Oh, look, it's someone on a horse.
For those of you that are not familiar here in the audience with the invisible cup of tea, this originated on the podcast because occasionally we don't have enough time to read or view something to bring to the podcast, so we come up with a common topic that we will then riff upon for several minutes in order to kill time and be vaguely entertaining or at least try to make each other laugh. So how about we let the audience come up with an invisible cup of tea topic? Because that can't possibly go wrong.
Over to you, Bob. Oh, my hand.
We are,
but that will come later.
That will come later. That is the finale. Okay. And we don't want to blow the finale to our fireworks display until we're right.
We are not the city of San Diego.
I'll be answering general questions tomorrow after my readings.
Yes. But the silly questions come at the very end, and that only takes about 5 minutes unless Lois's joke that she has the right to tell when we ask her what it is really, really long. So
there's a.
We don't have enough time, though. I mean, you could always have Paul explain the intricacies of cricket to the American mind.
Well, it's funny you should ask.
No!
I try and do that every week. That
Well, it's much more funny to have you just say dirty things.
Well, is that what the next 5 minutes is going to be?
That's not cricket.
Is there a topic we want to talk about? Is there a movie we've all seen? Do we want to talk about something like that? Or
I'm woefully behind on my movie watching.
Mm, me too.
Appreciative. My Netflix subscription, which has opened up the last half of the 20th century of film for my remedial television watching and movie watching.
So what are you watching?
Oh, let's see. I just watched something called The Story of India, which was nonfiction. What's in the queue? Tintin, the movie, is in my queue. What else has been good? I watched a ton of anime, which I had never had access to before.
So what anime series did you watch?
Put her on the spot, Lynn.
Let's see. There's a gazillion of them. Let's see. Otogi Zoshi springs to mind. Mushishi.
Mushishi is tremendous.
Isn't that great? Yeah, I really like the ones that have Japanese settings. It gives me this sort of cultural vibe thing going on.
Mushishi is a story about a wandering chap in Japan, could be any age of Japan, mm-hmm. Who fixes small ghost-related problems. Mm-hmm. He's like not a ghost exterminator, but he kind of does the mystical feng shui of your house.
There must be a shtick about traveling medicine men with their package on their back, because I've seen that character in a number of different incarnations in anime. Oh, there was another one. Goblin Cat. What was it called? Samurai Ghost Tales? No. Trying to think of the name of it. There's a really fantastic animation on that one. Which one was titled Goblin Cat, and then there was another series that hasn't come out on DVD yet that I've been waiting. It was a spin-off from.
My favorite Mushishi is the episode where there's just a string hanging out of the sky,
uh-huh.
and you really shouldn't. If you see a string hanging out of the sky, do not go and pull it.
But you know everybody will.
The one with the characters, the woman who had the ink. And had to write out her stories because otherwise the ink would rise and consume her body. That was creepy in a writerly sort of way. A lot of good stuff on that one. I first encountered anime back in the 80s when it was part of science fiction conventions and going on in a dark room that I didn't have time to explore much. But when I did poke my nose in, it would be a pirated videotape with no dubbing or subtitles, and some local fan standing up and doing simultaneous translation in front of the screen while it played, and everybody was watching. And someday I will get back to that. It came to me. It was good. It's been fun. Started on what is, to my taste, rather dark anime, which I will think of. Aphasia is a terrible thing at the time of the convention.
Anomia!
Not Millennium.
We may be a
Millennium Actress is also very good, but that isn't everything by Satoshi Kon, who I was very saddened to learn had died recently at the age of 46. It's like, no, I was waiting for your next film. Paprika is one of my very favorites of his.
We may well recognize it if you describe it.
Yeah, the one, the one with the watch and the two brothers, and yeah. And one's a suit of armor, and the other one is
Full Metal Alchemist.
Full Metal Alchemist.
Full Metal Alchemist. There we go. Thank you. It's very famous, and of course I couldn't pull up the name. I watched all gazillion episodes.
Are you watching the original or the new remake?
There's a new remake. Why?
They want it to follow the course of the manga more, because the original actually overtook the manga and made up its own stories, and then the manga did not follow it.
That might be fun. Yeah, I'm glad to know that. I'll have to look it up. If it's on Netflix, I can get it. A lot of stuff there. It's just, I watched good, I watched bad. I've got, I watched everything at first, and then I got pickier as I began to realize, I have, at this taste, I'm not interested in the giant fighting robot genre, subgenre whatsoever. I like certain things. I like the girl stuff. There was a exhibition came to the art museum here in town of shoujo manga original artwork that Pat and I went to see. It was just amazing. They had original art from Antique Bakery. That's another one. And the whole sort of girls and women's manga and anime. Not as much anime, because it's higher budget and it's more to the guys. It was just quite fascinating, and it was interesting watching myself as a art consumer, responding to this. There's more girl in me than I knew, because I really like those stories.
Can I try you with some titles to see?
Sure.
Have you seen Genshiken?
Yes. It's the one about the anime club?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a stitch.
It's a comedy in the vein of The Big Bang Theory about a group of nerds at in a university anime club.
In Japan.
The very non-nerdy girl who's one of their girlfriends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was fun. It was sort of like, I know all these types.
I've met these people.
I am these people. It was wonderful. Yeah, that was an excellent one.
A Lucky Star?
I have not seen that one.
Oh, that's a really good, fun schoolgirl friendship with lots of geek comedy again.
Okay, yeah.
The Melancholy of... help me. The Melancholy of...
Haruhi Suzumiya.
Haruhi Suzumiya.
Not that one. Mm. Yeah, I can't...
As a Manga Deo?
Follow up the names. Which one?
As a Manga Deo?
Have not seen that one. So a very weird one about the Chevalier d'Aeon. That was it. It was all French Revolutionary stuff that's sort of seen in process through Japanese manga artists. And it was like, they don't get Catholicism today.
Does anyone?
Yeah. And so it was sort of these, a lot of well-researched stuff and then these unchecked Japanese cultural assumptions sort of come leaking up through here and there with the way people behave or the way the magic works or or other things. And, you know, I bet we do that to them.
Oh, constantly. Yeah.
It was fascinating to watch. Very, very bizarre. Got very dark at the end. That's the other thing, but they're not afraid to have, like, unhappy endings because this is, like, a good way to wrap up, I guess, if you're doing Japanese drama. No, I want happy endings.
In the immortal words of Anne Hathaway, Will, can't you just kill them all off and come to bed? The secret explanation for the ending of Hamlet.
See, I find it kind of funny.
That makes so much sense.
I find it kind of funny that we're talking about anime because my introduction to anime was when we were living back in Connecticut. There was a good friend who owned a comic shop, and he was trying to get us into anime. And the first thing that we watched was Evangelion.
Oh.
But you have to understand that it was sold to me as, no, it's awesome. There's giant fighting robots. Which, if you've seen Evangelion, is really nothing close to what Evangelion is about at all. There are indeed giant fighting robots, but they are not the center of the plot. They are not the they're there, but they're only there to sort of break up the existential angst that is being explored from moment to moment.
They've had three more goes to end that since then.
Yeah.
I was wondering, watching all those, is what is the psychological need being served of wanting to become our machines in all these giant fighting robot stories? Yeah, there was something very disturbing about that.
And it's always a small child in the giant fighting
robot.
And people assume...
Small people, yeah.
People assume this is all part of the heart of Japanese culture, but actually it's because in the wake of World War II, only very specific foreign shows came in. And when Gerry Anderson's shows arrived, they were taken up with an enormous passion and have influenced every Japanese TV show ever since.
Yeah, I don't know Gerry Anderson. Quick explanation.
Oh, puppet shows like Thunderbirds, with big vehicles, and never did giant fighting robots.
Yeah.
But the show we were just talking about a moment ago.
Evangelion?
Evangelion, that one, yes. Yeah. Evangelion's title sequence is almost shot for shot Gerry Anderson's UFO with a very similar theme tune.
Oh, God. Huh. I never knew that.
One of the things that the Shoujo Manga exhibit, the art exhibit, had at the local art museum was retrospective, and it was by the decade, and you could see kind of the evolution of, in the 50s, it was very Disney-influenced, you know, and gradually, as the decades go on, kind of this tremendous Japanese art experience begins to leak up through and change it and make it more and more Japanese. It was quite fascinating to watch.
Is anybody else a fan of Slayers, which is the other anime that I've watched a fair amount of, mostly because I have our good friends often who were introducing us to anime thought that I might kind of identify with the main character whose name is Lena, who eats a lot and blows things up very loudly.
That doesn't sound like you, Lynn.
No, not at all. She's very exuberant, and it was a really sort of good example of the very arch way that a lot of the comedy anime is played. It's a really good example of that because it's basically sort of a medieval fantasy setting where you've got Lena, who is a sorceress, and her big spell is, you know, it's Dragon Slay, and she just sort of blows up cities by accident, because she's aiming for the dragon and missing. She's not very good at her job, but she's very entertaining. And then she has a swordsman that wanders around with her who is not terribly bright, but very, very sweet and deeply in love with her. And he just kind of follows her around like a puppy and tries to figure out why it is she keeps missing. And then there's lots of massive scenes where they're eating really, really big meals in a very frantic sort of manner where there's, like, food flying through the air, which I found kind of entertaining.
That's a cultural artifact I really find fascinating, the slow pans across the detail of what they're eating.
Yeah.
There's a country that suffered famine. Yeah. But,
Mirage of Blaze was another one that I got into fairly early on, and it was Japanese setting. It had, you know, reincarnated people from the past, you know, from the 16th century fighting, you know, warring states period, and you know, and the modern, you know, their modern incarnations. And it had the first male-male romance I had ever seen in cartoon, and that was like, wow, you wouldn't see this on American television. It was quite good, and very weird. And, you know, as one of the first animes that I was, brain was hit by it. Mm-hmm. It was, okay, let's see more of this, because this is like nothing I've seen before.
Yeah, there was another one that I watched called Love Hina. which is another comedy romance one, and it's about it's about a young university student trying desperately to, you know, attract young university students.
Have you seen Tales of Agriculture?
No.
Tales of Agriculture is about a college where they were a brewing college. Where they put microorganisms into beer and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it is both the adventures of our student heroes there and the microorganisms themselves that talk. And can be seen by our hero and nobody else. Okay. At one point, he sees this enormous towering monster walking down the street out of a shop and is frightened by it. And it's a local brewer, who, of course, his uniform is covered in these things. And they get in the way of a lot of anime, a little sequence of their own at the end, where you hear yeast going, "Beer brewing!" which is yeast's catchphrase.
Yeast is apparently the theme of this convention.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Came up this morning in the early women science fiction writers panel, where we were talking about Margaret St. Clair's Sign of the Labrys, in which the world-ending apocalyptic thing is killer yeast infections. Oh, my hand to God.
Oh my goodness, that's just awful. What a horrible way to go. Okay, we've got about 7 minutes left, so I think it's time to ask Lois some embarrassing questions.
That's just like the most awful Quatermass episode. Sorry.
We're going to ask Lois our silly questions, and she can answer them as she sees fit, and then we will wind things up and thank our studio audience and call it a day. And this episode will be streamed, this will be our August episode, so at some point, if you watch sfsqueecast.com, you will see that we will have actually had this edited together to some semblance of cogence and, well, yeah, some semblance, and it'll be out there for the world to see so that everyone can hear you laughing at our brilliant jokes. Okay, so these are the questions that we ask all of our guests on the Squeecast. Okay. The first question comes from Paul. It is, what do you most fear?
I was thinking about my dreams and nightmares. I have recurrent dreams. Usually I have recurrent dreams about being somehow responsible for a weird house that is falling apart in all these strange ways. There's a creek running through the basement and something else is going wrong. Yeah. So I think that there's something going on there with my fears. And the other is, of course, travel nightmares, usually involving airports and vast crowds and airplanes that are doing strange things like flying under the power lines. And there's only a crash once in one of my dreams. So I think the two things I fear most are staying home and traveling.
You know that,
according to my dreams,
that is supposedly, if the story is true, how James Doohan got kicked out of the Canadian Air Force with slaloming power lines.
That would explain an awful lot. Okay. Seanan, who is not here, alas, would like to know if she can have a cookie.
Yes, she may.
Okay.
Well, that was easy.
Yeah.
It's not normally as straightforward as that.
Yeah. Retired mom.
Okay. Her next question, Seanan's, is what is the first book that you remember reading on your own initiative?
I wish I could remember the title, because it was a little golden book. I was about 5 or 6. It was about a pony or foal. It wasn't My Pokey Pony, but it was something along that line. And it had pictures and, you know, the three lines of type, a nice big print. And it was my horse mania phase from about age 2 to about age 12 or 14. Anything with horses, Marguerite Henry, you name it. But that was one of the very first. It was a horse book.
Cool. Paul would like to know, what have you done today to make him feel proud?
No idea.
Oh, come on, have a go.
I made it here on time.
I was going to say, you showed up for the Squeecast.
And did you find parking?
Yes, I found parking.
Oh, at this convention. Yeah.
I was in the distant lot this morning, but I just took a tour around this afternoon when I came back, and there was somebody pulling out. You know, the parking fairy was with me.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, Bear would like to know, what do you want on your tombstone?
Actually, I'm not sure I want a tombstone. I'd rather be having my ashes scattered someplace that I liked, in like the old lake that my grandfather had a cottage at or something like that. You know, just skip the whole. I don't like funerals. I don't want to make anyone go to mine because I hate going to funerals. Just skip over all that and just, you know, take care. I mean, there are public health issues that have to be dealt with, but once that's over, I'm done.
Okay. What is your favorite joke? This is Bear's question. And do feel free to tell it.
Yes,
you need not be, you can be dirty.
I actually have provenance for this joke. It's not dirty. It's a little bit cruel. Because we were making up telling jokes at a party after a local convention, and Steve Bruce came up with this one. So I can actually give credit. We're telling light bulb jokes. Is how many new writers does it take to change a light bulb? To which the answer is, never mind that. Let me tell you about my light bulb. And I was like, ah.
At this point, the panel would normally devolve into 15 minutes of telling Steve Bruce's light bulb jokes. Because there are a lot of them, and they're all pretty funny.
It's very, very, you had to have been there, one of them, but it just it holds up. So carry on.
Okay, Bear would also like to know, what is your quest?
No, that's not me. That's Kat.
Is that Kat?
I'm pretty sure that's Kat.
That is Kat. My mistake. Kat would like to know
I've had a lot of quests, but, you know, I'm 62 now, and it's like, you know, how long is it till I get Social Security and Medicaid? Things like that. You know, the quests are kind of narrow.
So your quest is healthcare.
That's been an ongoing quest for quite some time. You know, sort of being an American, I'm, you know, it's like succeed or die is not. Yeah. Not a turn of phrase.
You poor things.
Yeah. A few words about that, but that gets into politics, which would be...
That would be messy.
Yeah. Would not be squeeful.
Not be squeeful. Okay. What is your favorite guilty pleasure?
Well, we talked about anime, and I'm not sure how guilty that is, really, in my context. I have occasionally been known to read fanfic. There was a period during the early... part of the last decade here that I got into Lord of the Rings fanfic. I had never been interested in it as a result of reading the books. The books were always enough. They were completed in themselves if I wanted more. I read the books. Then the movies came out. And interestingly enough, it was the year that my mother was dying that I read fanfic because of looking back on it and thinking, you know, why was this suddenly more interested than any of the other bazillion things I could have been reading? And I think it was fiction without responsibility at a time when I had too damn many others. It was a good thing. So I don't know how guilty that is. I throw off guilt.
What is your favorite word?
There are so many. It's English. We've got 750,000 to choose from. I always liked adumbration. That was a vocabulary word that came to me late, as some still do. You know, every once in a while I will learn a new word. And it was like, okay. There was a reason I read this Henry James book. I learned a new word.
So what does it mean for our viewers that may not be familiar with it?
Foreshadowing.
Umbra
is the root in there.
That's lovely.
Yeah, that is lovely. See, you learn a new word every month on the SF Squeakcast.
I learned a great new word.
You did?
Petrichor. Which is the smell of dry ground after a rain during a drought. It's blood, it's stone blood, is petrichor.
Well, that's a Fannish reference as well.
Yes, it is, because that's the name of the evil pharmaceutical company in Torchwood.
And it's the name of the perfume that
Amy Pond was promoting in Doctor Who.
Because it comes from the doctor's wife. It's one of the passwords to get into the old console.
Yeah, it's a password for the console room in the doctor's
There's
life.
Words in there everywhere.
Oh my goodness, there's so many words. Okay.
That was the other video I watched, the Adventure of English, which was like, oh, put it all together. Yes, we've had bits of these in English courses, but this had the whole structure in four episodes or six episodes. I love my Netflix subscription. Carry on.
That's it.
That's it. This is the part where we thank everybody. So thank you, Bear and Paul, and our special guest, Lois McMaster-Bujold. Special thanks to our webmaster, Dimitri Zagadulin, our tech producer, David McCone-Chase, Jeff Bonoff at Mystic Fig Studios, who provided instrumentals by Shauna McGuire, Katie Shuttleworth, who made our rockin' logo, and Michael Thomas for general administration support. Again, a special thanks to the programming team at Convergence, especially Tim Wick, who made this recording possible, and...
Matt,
who's sitting right behind us recording this as we speak. We hope that you will join us next time. Same squee time, same squee channel. And we're out.